I'd like to talk about one of the oldest subjects in geometry, polyhedra and symmetry. And as we know, symmetry has played a role from the very early times on, and here are the five platonic solids everyone knows. Dodecahedron, icosahedron, tetrahedron, octahedron, and cube. And I'm putting this up to illustrate the Schläfli symbol. Each of these platonic solids is described by the Schläfli symbol consisting of two entries, 3 and 5. The 3 tells you that the faces are triangles, and the 5 tells you that there are 5 triangles at every vertex. And historically, the next major development really happened a few hundred years ago with the discovery of the Kepler-Ponsot polyhedra. And what is different now, the faces and vertex links can be star polygons, so pentagrams, for example. Yeah? So here, for example, in this polyhedron, you see the faces are pentagons, and the way in which they meet at the vertex is described by a pentagram. So let me also just tell you about the vertex concept of the vertex figure. This vertex figure at a vertex joins the adjacent vertex in the manner in which they are joined by the faces. So if you focus on the top vertex here, then here's an adjacent vertex, then this is the next adjacent vertex, this is the next, and so on. You see, it goes in a pentagram fashion. And major developments then happened in the 19th century through Schläfli's work in particular, and then, of course, everyone is familiar with it, with Coxeter's influential work that brought together geometry and algebra. So, summarizing all of this is, with the passage of time, there have been many changes in point of view about polyhedra, and the focus was always on different things. So, for example, with the platonic solids, the focus was on solids, and implicitly also on convexity, although that concept wasn't there at the time. Then with the Kepler-Ponsot polyhedra, star polygons got into the game as faces or vertex figures, and then there's another class of regular polyhedra, and what is this? These are the so-called Petrie-Coxeter polyhedra, and here you see them at the bottom. So what are those? Well, first of all, they have convex faces as the platonic solids, but now the way in which they are surrounding a vertex is described by skew polygons. So if you focus on, I don't know if you can actually see this. Yeah, this is the polyhedron with symbol type 6-4. If you focus on a vertex, then look at the adjacent vertices, it goes up and down, up and down. Yeah, so there's a skew vertex figure. And that automatically forces the whole structure to be infinite, so that these are infinite polyhedra. And there are 3 of them, as classified by Coxeter and Petrie. And then a very important development happened in the mid-1970s when Grünbaum got interested, and he gave a very important impetus in 2 ways. One is geometrically, and the other is combinatorially. And I will be focusing more on the geometric aspect. And the basic question was this: what are the regular polyhedra in ordinary space? And we have already seen 3 different classes, and so the important first thing was to introduce the right concept of a polyhedron. And it turned out that this is really a skeletal approach to polyhedra that drives the whole thing. We're not really interested in polyhedra where the faces are spanned by membranes. We're only interested in the cycle structure. Yes, so faces are cycles. And the polyhedron is a collection of cycles that fit together in the same way in which faces of a polyhedron would fit together. That was Grünbaum's idea, the skeletal approach to polyhedra, which is essentially graph theoretical. Yeah, so the focus is on the geometric graphs, but equipped with a polyhedral structure. And his initial idea was basically this: he writ the theory of polyhedra of the psychologically motivated block that membranes must be spanning faces. That was the initial motivation. And that means allow skew faces in particular. Yeah, because then there is not a natural way to associate it actually a piece of a surface. And then implicit in this approach was to restore the notion, to restore symmetry in the the definition of a polyhedron by allowing skew faces and not only skew vertices. And this might look a little silly to you initially, but it turned out that this is actually exactly the right thing to do. And because that's what the groups really force. If you want to create a theory where polyhedra and groups are sort of categorically equivalent, then this is what you have to do. If you want polyhedral model for certain types of groups, then exactly you have to go to this skeletal approach. So I think it's time for a formal definition of what a polyhedron is. A polyhedron P in Euclidean 3 space is a family of simple polygons called faces, such that each edge of a face is an edge of just one other face, familiar from convex polyhedra, then all faces incident with the vertex form one circuit. So there's a natural way of actually sort of moving around a vertex. P is connected, what basically says that the edge graph is connected here. And we want a discreteness assumption, namely saying that each compact set needs only finitely many faces. So this is a polyhedron, yeah? A collection of cycles in space related in the same way in which faces of polyhedra are related, convex polyhedra. And then we call such an object, such a polyhedron, regular if its geometric symmetry group is transitive on the flags. And the flag here is an incident triple of a vertex, an edge, and a face. Why are we using this definition? This is the one that's most flexible among all the various definitions of regularity. Yeah?
So the polyhedron is
essentially two-dimensional. Yeah. Abstractly, it's sort of a...
And it really doesn't have to be a
D3,
does it?
No. But that's right. Yeah, so... But I will focus on the three-dimensional. Okay? So let me show you an example how you could possibly think about this. So you see here the 8 cubes. They are not really there. They just serve as reference points. And I will now try to construct the neighborhood of one single vertex. And the vertex is the central one. And I use hexagons, six around that vertex. And what we do is we take PT polygons, so zigzags on the cube. So here's the first hexagon. And then along this edge, I take another hexagon. And then at this edge, I take now the green hexagon. And then I keep going here, down here, there's a fourth one, and the fifth one, and finally it closes up. So there are six hexagons that surround this particular vertex. Yeah? So you have built one neighborhood of a single vertex. And this structure really can be extended throughout space. So this just one vertex and it's the neighborhood of it. Yeah, so it continues in this fashion. Here's a close-up shot of this. Type 6-6, yeah? We have hexagons have faces, six coming together at each vertex. Here is a local picture of a polyhedron of type 4-6. Now we have squares, but they need not be flat squares. They are sort of tetragons. Yeah, but all the edges are the same. And six come together at each vertex. Yeah, so here you see, again, sort of the six the eight cubes are there for reference. And you see, if you focus here on the green square, you see that the vertex opposite to the center is lying on the axis, on the y-axis. Yeah, there's just six of them. And so how do the original P.T. Coxeter polyhedra fit into this game? Well, they are described by these two properties, convex faces and skew vertex figures. That forces the There are just three such polyhedrons. So now I've shown you a couple of examples which have skew vertex figures. How about examples with skew faces? And I construct an example from the from one of the P.T. Coxeter polyhedra, here from this grid-like structure. And this is a symbol here. The 464 is a symbol for this P.T. Coxeter polyhedron. The first two entries are the standard Schlafly symbol entries, and this 4 describes this, the length of a certain edge path in the polygon. So what we do is we bicolor the vertices of this P.T. Coxeter polyhedron, black and white. So there are two color classes, black and white. And at the white vertices, here's the white vertex, and again in the typical fashion, yeah? So as in the case of a bicoloration, adjacent vertices have different colors. So here are the white vertices. This is another white vertex. So what we do is we take the vertex figure of the P.T. Coxeter polyhedron at the white vertices. And that's, you see, this is exactly a skew hexagon. You can see it. The green vertices lie in one plane, sort of to the front, and the blue vertices lie in the back. That's where you see this, that this is really skew. And if you focus in on this, if you look at the vertex figure at one of the black vertices, so to speak, you will see that is actually planar. The vertex figures are planar. Yeah, so this, if you do this systematically at all the white vertices, you get an infinite polyhedron which is made up from skew hexagons, six coming together at each vertex. That's the symbol. Okay, so these are some examples, and of course the way to classify them is by looking at the symmetry group of these polyhedra. And it turns out that the symmetry group is generated by three reflections. And these are not reflections in planes, so hyperplanes, so to speak. These are not hyperplane reflection groups. These are groups generated by reflections in points, lines, or planes. Yeah, so a point reflection is clear, it's sort of a central inversion in that point. Reflection in a line is just a half turn about the line. And of course we have standard plane reflections. And as is familiar from the from platonic solids, there are standard relations that have to hold that sort of capture the Schlafly symbol. Namely, R0 R1 to the P is 1. That says that R0 R1 is really sort of combinatorially rotating the edges in a two-phase, as in the case of a regular map. And similarly here, R1, R2 to the Q is 1. That means R1, RQ combinatorially rotates the vertices adjacent to a given vertex. And in general, there are more relations, of course, and that's really sort of where the geometry of the polyhedron comes from. The cycle structure of the polyhedron really describes the additional relations. And a particularly powerful thing here is the Witthoff construction. And the Witthoff construction was discovered for regular polytopes in high dimensions a long time ago, and what it effectively is sort of an algorithmic approach to constructing a polyhedron from the group. Yeah, so you have two things. There's a group and there's a polyhedron, and you can get the polyhedron from the group by Witthoff construction. Yeah, so it effectively gives you a very good method of constructing those. So having said all this, you can say that the classification of regular polyhedra in free space, in this case, is actually the classification of triples of reflections, of reflection groups of this kind, generated by three reflections, general reflections, but R0 and R2 must commute, that's this relationship, and R1 and R2 have a point in common that simply says is that sort of the initial point from which you construct the whole polyhedron by an orbit construction. And Grimmer and Grass enumerated the regular polyhedra first a long time ago, And Peter and I gave an alternative approach to this. Okay, so let me quickly summarize some of the interesting aspects of the enumeration. And here is sort of one picture that describes the finite regular polyhedra. So everyone is familiar with the five platonic solids. And there are also these four Kepler-Poinsot polyhedra. So we have five classical regular polyhedra. And then there are the Petri duals of those. So what is a Petri dual of a polyhedron? First of all, what is a Petri polygon? The Petri polygon of a polyhedron is a zigzag along the edges of the polyhedron. Yeah, sort of at every vertex, you leave alternately one to the right or left. Yeah, a zigzag. And if you take a polyhedron and take all the possible Petri polygons for it, then that's the Petri dual. Yeah, so the family of Petri polygons forms another polygon called the Petri dual of the original polyhedron. So if we take the Petrials of these four things, we get nine. And that's, in fact, the whole class of objects. And they're very nicely related. So, for example, this pi stands for the Petri operation, passing from a polyhedron to its Petri dual. And delta would be duality, and there are various other relations. So there are altogether 18 such operations. And one of the neat things is you actually have completely control. You not only have the geometric operation of going from a polyhedron to its dual or its petriole, you also have the way of actually going from the generators to the new generators. Yeah? So there's a correspondence between sort of geometric and algebraic operations, so to speak. And that's a very powerful tool. So these are 18, but there are 30 more. Okay, that's maybe not so well known, but there are 30 more. And these are all infinite. And the symmetry groups are crystallographic groups, so discrete groups of isometries which have a compact fundamental domain. And the classification naturally splits in the following way. First of all, there are six planar objects. The six planar objects, well, now we have a floor with carpet. You can't see it immediately, but these are the standard regular tessellations of the... Yeah. Okay. Here is a regular tessellation under the ceiling. And so there are three kinds of those. So there are three regular polyhedra under the ceiling. And now you can also look at Petri duals, the petrioles of those. What are the Petri polygons? They are zigzags, yeah, in this tessellation. So you have the three regular tessellations, and you have the three Petri duals of those. They now have zigzag faces. And then there are 24 more of these infinite polyhedra, and 12 are reducible, or we call them blends, and 12 are irreducible. What really that means is that the group, the symmetry group, is affinely reducible here, so there is a plane such that the group permutes, translates over that plane. So it's sort of the breaks down into, in a way, an action, a planar action and a linear action, so to speak. And there are 12 irreducible. So let me first focus on the reducible ones. We have this, remember, you have this condition for the Witthoff construction. There must be a fixed point of R1 and R2. Must be a common fixed point. That's right, that reduces quite a bit. And also, R0 and R2 must commute. Yeah? Yeah, that restricts it, yeah. So the reducible, 12 reducible polyhedra. So I explained that there are 6 regular polyhedra in the plane. And there are also 6 regular polyhedra or regular structures on the line, namely the unit interval and the unit, the tessellation of the line by unit interval. So what we do now is we take, so 6 times 2 is 12. That's where the 12 comes from. So what we do now is we take a planar regular polyhedron, like the square tessellation, and we take one of the two on the line, and now we blend them together. So for example, unfortunately this thing is up here now, so we go up there and pull down every other vertex, just a little bit. And what you would get is a roof structure, literally, yeah? So where every other vertex is lifted to a second height. Yeah, so that would be a blend of the square tessellation and the line segment. What is that? Well, I didn't catch that. What is that? I won't be invited again here then. So, and then there's a second way of doing this. Now we take again the square tessellation, and now we take the tessellation on the line. And now we blend it, and that would mean is we sort of take helices coming down now. Yeah, so every facet, three-dimensional facet, would be a helix. Yeah, so the square, which is sort of a projection of the structure against the helix, yeah, so would go like this, yeah? If you adjacent squares give you oppositely running down helices. Yeah, so all these 12 objects are made like this. Yeah, so you have a two-dimensional projection, so to speak, that is a six-dimensional. This is one of the 6 planar objects, and a linear projection that's either line segment or tessellation on the line. And of course, there are the other ones that really are the troublemakers in some ways. And these are the 12 irreducible ones. And they're all very closely related. And again, they can be described by operations. And so the operations on the algebraic level are mentioned here. So in addition to those that were all on the previous slide, or one of the earlier slides. So let me point out a few things here. These here on top were the Petri-Coxeter polyhedra, 2 of them. And here's a 3rd Petri-Coxeter polyhedron. And then you can look at the Petri dual, for example, apply pi. So in other words, take this polyhedron and all forget about the faces and just take the Petri polygons of that structure. That gives you an object like this. So now you have helices again. Here you can do the same. Pi is Petri operation. Halving operation I illustrated before, that was a way of actually constructing skew faces, yeah, where I was bicoloring the vertices, that is this object. And I also want to tell you a little bit about these two. They are related again by Petri dual. And maybe I'll skip that. This is downtown Manhattan, and this is actually an example of one of the helical polyhedra. And so what you do is you take the square tessellation of the plane, and in 1/4 of the squares, you build towers. Yeah, so you have a tower here, you have a central tower, and so on, throughout the plane. And then in those towers, you take staircases. See, they run up. And you build the staircase in such a way that you can actually cross bridges. That you can build bridges from a tower to an adjacent tower, from here to here, and from here to here again, from here to here. And once you have done this, you have built a skeleton of the polyhedron, and one third of the possible helical faces. Here in this case, the one third runs from the bottom up, sort of runs vertically. But the same graph, the same edge graph, can be interpreted in two other ways as providing you helices, namely from the left to the right, these are the green ones here, and from the front to the back. Yeah, so if you take this graph here, that's actually known in crystallography, I think it's 10 sub 3 or something like that, but it actually has polyhedral structure. So you can put these three classes of helices on it, and it becomes a regular polyhedron. Here's sort of from the top of the tower, a view from the top of the tower. Yeah, so the squares, the blue ones, will project into the square, and the one coming here. This basically concludes the enumeration of regular polyhedron. Yeah, so there are 48 falling down to 80 finite, 30 infinite, 6 planar, 12 reducible, 12 irreducible. So how about chiral polyhedron? So what should be a chiral polyhedron? The term chiral here is to mean maximally chiral, so to speak. That means you have as many symmetries as you can possibly have, but not regularity in the strong sense in which we are. So one way to describe it is this. There are two orbits on the flags under the geometric symmetry group, such that adjacent flags are always in different orbits. Yeah, so that's the last condition is important. The adjacent flags you want to be in different orbits. So in other words, that force is sort of like a left and right handedness, at least combinatorially in some sense. So you can also define it locally. That would be the sort of the global definition. You can also give a local definition. So if you take here, that picks up on your question, so the whole object can be viewed as a map on a surface, right? If the faces are finite. And what you want to have is two now geometric operations, S1 and S2, that cyclically permute the vertices around a face, and the faces around the vertices, the faces around one particular vertex of that face. So this would be S1, this would be S2. And again, we have standard relations in general more. So let me sort of rephrase a few things. We want maximal rotational symmetry, but the rotational is meant really in a combinatorial sense, so that we can have combinatorially rotating objects, but no reflexive symmetry, so the flags are not, adjacent flags are not equivalent. So let's make a few observations, sort of to put everything into context. First of all, I didn't know any examples when we started this, and then this phenomenon doesn't show up among convex polytopes. So there's an old theorem by Peter McMahon that there are no chiral convex polytopes. So that's bad news, right? So there's nothing classical. Then a piece of good news, yes, you can sort of use this S1 and S2, which has a property that the product of the two actually acts like a half turn about an edge, at least combinatorially. That can be exploited again to use to come up with a variant of Vitov's construction. So you do have again this strong situation that there's this type of groups and polyhedra, and you have this way of connecting them. Then you start by observing there are no finite chiral polyhedra. Yeah, so you would think maybe if we take finite subgroups of O3, that you can somehow manufacture something, a finite chiral object from it. No, that's not true. As soon as you have this S1 and S2 in there, you actually do have reflexibility. I mean, if you do have actually more, you have this you have reflective symmetry as well. So that's bad news. And then there are also no planar objects and also no blended objects. So you cannot hope to construct something three-dimensional by sort of blending together a two-dimensional thing and a linear thing. So it turns out that the classification then breaks down naturally into the finite phase polyhedra and infinite phase, and then automatically helix phase, as a matter of fact, polyhedra. And let me first talk about the finite phase chiral polyhedra. And what's the situation there? These S1 and S2 that I mentioned, they are actually rotatory reflections in free space. So what that is a rotation about an axis followed by a reflection in the plane perpendicular to the axis. Yeah? So you rotate and then you flip in that plane. So that forces automatically this skew behavior. Yeah? So up, down, up, down, up, down. Not necessarily, though, but it could be that your initial point is sort of creating an equator, but that's not the standard situation. Yeah? So S1 and S2 are rotatory reflection, and skew faces and skew vertices. And the interesting thing is that there are no regular polyhedra that have both. Regular polyhedra either have either planar faces or planar vertex figures. It's quite interesting, actually. So only chirality can produce it. And it turns out there are three very large classes of finite phase chiral polyhedra, and they are of type 6-6, 4-6, and 6-4. And the families are described by two integral parameters. If we classify by congruence, then there are two integral parameters, and which are relatively prime, and that's the discreteness, so to speak. You have the polyhedra also for arbitrary parameters, but they won't be discrete. And this is a self-Yule class, as a matter of fact. And it turns out that there's a natural way of describing these three classes, such that within each class you actually have two regular polyhedra. Mysterious. There's one big class, and in that class there are two regular polyhedra. And they occur when exactly this breaks down, when one of the faces or the vertex figures become planar. Yeah, so if the that's actually here, you see if B is negative A, that is one of our polyhedra that I constructed from the Petri Coxeter polyhedra by bicoloring the vertices. And actually, you get also one of these PT Coxeter polyhedron of type 6-6 here, the classical one. Yeah, so it's very interesting. You have this big class of objects of type 6-6, and in that big class, there are two singular elements, namely which are regular. And similarly, you have those here of type 4-6. And that's actually the dual class, 6-4. Again, two integral parameters, and two regular polyhedra in that class. And vertex sets and translation groups and phase structure and so on are pretty well known, or well described. And the one that I showed you initially, that was actually a chiral polyhedron, and because it had skew faces and skew vertex figures. Yeah, so it's one of the chiral polyhedra. In fact, it's the simplest chiral polyhedra. Yes, it's just the neighborhood of a single vertex. P1, 0. So A is 1, B is 0. Yes, in general, they can get, the faces can get huge, and they also don't run along the edges of the cubical tessellation. Yeah? So they can, in this particular class, they always lie in planes parallel to the coordinate planes. But they can get huge, these hexagons. They come out, go back, and then return. And so it can happen that there's another face far out there that actually is very close to this one, and possibly even intersecting. I mean, linking them. Here's another, this is the example that I showed before, that's Q11 of type 4-6. So we have these tetragons or squares, six coming together at each vertex. So this is neighborhood of a single vertex. And then we go to helices, helix face polyhedra. So now these generators S1 and S2, remember what S1 was? It rotated sort of combinatorially the vertices in a face, and now it will sort of work like this, yeah? Will actually be a screw motion, so to speak. And S2 combinatorially rotated the edges around a vertex. And now it turns out there are three very large classes, I will get to that soon, with very spectacular properties, actually. I think spectacular properties. Now, Schlaefer symbol infinity 3, that means we have helices as faces, and they are helices over triangles. So if you project along the helix axis, you would project on a regular on a triangle. So these are helices over triangles. In the second class, you have helices over squares, like downtown Manhattan thing. And in the third class, you actually have four helices coming together at each vertex, but now the helices are over triangles. And here, what I wrote down is a special group. That's the group of, that's the quotient of the full symmetry group by the translation subgroup. That's a special group. And there are actually very neat relationships to the finite phase chiral polyhedra. And so, for example, if you take one of these polyhedra, finite phase polyhedra of type 6-6, so PAB, and look at the so-called two holes, then they form helices. Then they are the faces of this helix face polyhedra. And the two holes are passed along edges, such that at each vertex you leave two to the right. Yes, so at every vertex, like on a map on a surface, you pass along edges, but at each vertex you continue by leaving two on the right. There are two faces on the right. Then in a PT polygon, you'd go one right, one left, one right, one left. But now you actually take, leave two faces always on the same side, on the right. And these are the so-called two holes, because in the PT Coxeter polyhedra, they are actually the holes. Yeah, so that's why they, they are actually holes in there. Okay. And now, in this particular case, you have, again, this big, huge family. Actually, now the parameters can be real numbers. That's different from the previous case. Yes, in the first case, you have integral parameters, and they were relatively prime, these two integrals. But now you can have real parameters. And again, I'm pointing out that the parameters, you have two parameters because we classify by congruence. If we would classify by similarity, we have a single parameter, namely the quotient of the two parameters. And so if you classify by similarity, then in the first case, you actually have effectively a rational parameter describing the whole class, A over B. And I'll get back to that. There's a very interesting phenomenon associated with this observation. Well, in any case, in these three helix phase classes, you have again two regular objects, but I wrote down only one of them. Here, this is downtown Manhattan. Here, this one here in the middle that I pointed out. This is the Petri dual of downtown. Yeah. But there are also three finite ones. in those classes. It's sort of a singular event happening. I have not included those here. But let me, this is the example that I showed you, but this is actually the regular example. Actually a regular example, so you could sort of slightly deform it and you get chiral examples. Okay, here are some interesting facts about these chiral polyhedron. It turns out that essentially it is true that any two finite-faced polyhedra are non-isomorphic. So if you just look at polyhedra with the same parameter, any two finite-faced polyhedra of the same type are non-isomorphic. So in other words, if you change the parameters in the class PAB just slightly, except for possibly changing signs, you always get something non-isomorphic. And that's particularly maybe confusing, at least for me, if you pass to this to the similarity classes, then you have a rational parameter, A over B, and if you only very slightly change this rational parameter, you immediately get a non-isomorphic class. Yeah, so let's pray there's some very strong discontinuity. Combinatorial non-isomorphic. Okay. And that's the first observation. The second was made by Daniel, Pellicer, and Asia. And they proved that these finite-faced polyhedra are actually intrinsically chiral. That means they are also combinatorially chiral, not only geometrically chiral. Yeah, so that even as sort of regular maps on a surface, they are chiral. That means there is no hidden combinatorial automorphism that moves the flag to an adjacent flag. Now the helix-faced one, that's particularly interesting, I think. The helix-faced chiral polyhedra are all combinatorially irregular. So, in other words, geometrically they are chiral, but combinatorially they are actually regular, so you have this other half of combinatorial automorphism. And the reason for that is that there is actually a way of deforming the chiral polyhedra to a regular polyhedron in their class. So there are chiral deformations, so to speak, of regular polyhedra. Yeah? So in other words, there are combinatorially only three different types of chiral polyhedra. Yeah? Because he can always be moved into the chiral one. Yeah? That's also in Asia's and Daniel's work. Oops. Yeah. A few more observations which make this interesting. And the chiral helix-faced polyhedra unravel the platonic solids. And that simply means here, I mean, you can sort of describe it algebraically by saying, okay, I take the quotient by the translation group. And what happens here, if you take the first class, then you actually, they collapse to the simplex. So what you can think of is this class of object is obtained by sort of taking the triangles of the tetrahedron and sort of unraveling them so that they become helices. Yeah? So there's a way of sort of describing that naturally. This class unravels the cube. And this class unravels the octahedron. There are icosahedron and dodecahedron missing, but they come from non-discrete polyhedron. They would come from non-discrete polyhedron. That part isn't done yet. And the final observation about these chiral polyhedra is that it all fits together in a nice picture. And again, we have this net of relationships between them. And so here is this family, P, Q, P, Q, and Q star are the finite-faced chiral polyhedra. And delta stands for duality, so from Q we go to Q star. Then we had this whole operation that I described, taking a polyhedron and taking the holes, all the holes of that polyhedron. That's what we call phi 2. Here phi 2 algebraically does this at the bottom, you see. That's how you pass from a generator to the new generating set. And there's another relation like this halving operation, which I'm not going to describe. As P itself is self-dual. But these relationships don't actually hold on the individual level. They hold on the class, on the level of classes. That means it can happen that you have to change parameters. Yeah? So for example, here, if you have QCD here, it's not CD again that you would get as parameters here. There's a linear combination of the parameters that's happening. So they all fit together very nicely. Yeah? So these are the chiral polyhedron. And here are the algebraic relationships that transfer from one to the other. I know I'm sort of nearing the end of the story. Let me then say a few words about so-called, remember the talk was two-orbit polyhedra. And we already talked about the chiral polyhedra, they are two-orbit polyhedra. And now there's another way in which you can have two orbits. Remember the critical definition, or the critical part of the definition required that adjacent flags are always in distinct orbits. If you drop this, you could have orbits in a different way. Yeah? So, with my student, Anthony Kepler, we have looked at the finite regular polyhedra of index 2 in this tree. And I have to tell you what that is. First of all, we require that the objects we want to study are actually combinatorially fully regular. So you have all possible combinatorial symmetries that you could possibly, that you want to have. Yeah? So the combinatorial automorphism group is flag transitive. But you want that the geometric symmetry group has index 2. Yeah? So roughly speaking, you can summarize this as saying you want combinatorial regularity, but geometric regularity fails by a factor of 2, so that half of the combinatorial automorphisms are hidden, but only a half, not all of them. That's not what you want. And that's a notion that was introduced by Jörg Wilds already a long time ago, actually. And at that time, he was actually focusing on orientable polyhedra, so on orientable surfaces, and the faces were planar. That's a planar-faced orientable polyhedra of index 2. That was the interest. And it turns out there are 5 such polyhedra. And the same question can, of course, be asked in the skeletal context. What are the skeletal polyhedra of index 2? And here, by the way, the 5 Wilds polyhedra are from David Richter's website. Here they are. And here are his models. And he is there, and you can ask him all about it. And so here is, this one is particularly interesting. Here you see sort of the outline of the dodecahedron. And here's the vertex of the dodecahedron. And now what you do is, you take sort of the edges opposite to the vertex in the faces that contain the vertex. Yeah, so there are 3 pentagons containing that vertex, and you take the opposite edges. And then you can join them like as this, yeah, like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, so and if you do this, you get this polyhedron of type 6, 6, sub 6 at genus 11. Yeah, so that would be a planar-faced polyhedron of genus 11. And then it turns out the classification of the finite polyhedra yields exactly 32 regular polyhedra of index 2. And And all of them have actually full symmetry group. I have to go forward a little bit. So here, what does that mean? We have full combinatorial regularity. That's what we want. We have the generators, row not row 1 and row 2, that sort of map a flag onto an adjacent flag. But geometrically, we can only do what we did, what we indicate here with the arrows. Yeah, so geometrically, you can rotate around the face. And by the way, this class is invariant under Petri duality. And it turns out that, one second. Yes, so the classification splits naturally into looking at polyhedra. There can only be two vertex orbits as a consequence of the fact that we have one or two vertex orbits, I should say, as a consequence of the fact that we have only two flag orbits. And the if we have two vertex orbits, there are 22 polyhedra, and there's one vertex orbit, there are 10 polyhedra, and I don't have the time to go through all of them. 18 of them are actually, of the two orbit cases, are related to the 18 ordinary irregular polyhedra that I showed you, the platonic solids and the Kepler-Poinsot, and Kepler-Poinsot plus the petriot. But there are four others. And so we have them all. And here, let me just show you how you can construct polyhedra on two face orbits, 18 of them, more or less in a uniform fashion. Namely, you take two concentric platonic solids, and then you line up faces that correspond to each other. Here's a little triangle inside and outside, and you join them in a suitable fashion. And that can be done in a consistent manner for 18 of these polyhedra. But there are others. Not all of them are given in this way. And it really, so I'm only showing one face. Yeah, that's one face, and you close up the whole figure by applying all symmetries of the octahedron. Okay. Say again? I think so, yeah. Of course, it's branch, so to speak, yeah, over the faces, or the centers of the faces. But I think it's a double color, yeah. Let me show you some more complicated faces. Here you see pentagons giving rise to decagons. And if you take, yeah, you see here these decagons, they can be very fancy, actually. And if you then close them up, under the symmetries, you get the whole polyhedron, yeah? If you take all the symmetries of the dodecahedron, and you get a polyhedron. And so there are lots of them. Here are just a few more. These are those with one face orbit. And I guess it's about time for me to stop.